All right. I'm going to try to move quickly because Kathy and Rod are going to come up, and we're going to interview them and stuff like that. So let's get started. Last week, we were in Proverbs 5 and 6 and 7, and we were talking about, we started sort of our little conversation about sexuality in our culture, and I had my mom come and talk with me, and having my mother talk is always a risk because, for me personally, because it's my mom, and if people don't like my mom, I have this expectation that you all do, and if you don't, then it makes me feel bad about myself, which is my own issue, but still, it's rather exposing. And there's kind of three ways that somebody would respond to my mother, and you guys kind of did it in the textbook way. You either don't know what the heck she was talking about, you either loved her to death, or she made you really angry. I got all three of those responses from you guys. It's probably the most talked about to me sermon of my illustrious career as a speaker. So anyway, today, I just want to kind of offer you, we're going to look at Proverbs chapter 5, verses 15 to 23. But I want to kind of open up, just kind of trying to define a few terms, trying to look at, offer us a good place to start. And recently, the leadership team, last week on Monday, Wednesday, we talked about holiness. Because I think before we talk about men and women and what it's like to be single and pure and what it's like to be in a marriage and what it's like to operate in this culture, we really have to kind of look at ourselves as humans first. And one of the keys to being human and being a follower of Jesus is to be holy. If you look at 1 Peter, it's in the front of your page, verse 13, it says, and following, it says, therefore, prepare your minds for action, which is important. As we talk about sexuality and roles of men and women and how that works in marriage and all that kind of stuff, and outside of marriage, you need to begin to prepare your mind for action. You need to begin to focus, because one of the things in our culture is we're constantly offered little grooves as to the way we understand things in life. For instance, if you watch a movie, you are forced to watch the way the cameraman is looking at people. And that trains a groove in your brain to the way you'll look at people. And so you have to be ready, discipline your mind as we talk about these things and think about the way you are influenced. Be self-controlled. Set your hope fully on the grace to be given you when Jesus Christ is revealed. As obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance. But just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all that you do. For it is written, be holy because I am holy. In a leadership meeting, we talked about how holiness is not a word that you and I most of the time hang out with our friends and say, hey, are you pretty holy? Yeah, I'm holy. I'm gelling. You know, we probably say that more than we say holy, right? You're gelling? Yeah, I'm gelling. Bad joke. Well, at least some of you get it, so some of you watch TV. But anyway, but holiness is not something that we talk a lot about. But holiness, both in the Greek and the Hebrew, simply means to be set aside for a purpose. And so kind of one of the words that Karen came up with that I think is better than holiness for our culture is sacred. Somehow our culture likes the word sacred, and something sacred has a particular purpose. And we talked about, as we've talked through Corinthians, that our ministry as villagers and as Christians, out of Corinthians, Paul tells us that we are ministers of reconciliation. That you and I, the purpose that we're made sacred if we're followers of Jesus, is that we're called to offer Jesus to people. We're called to reconcile the world to God and to each other to be reconciled through Jesus. And I think if you're offering Jesus, then you're offering life. And that's important. You as a human being, as a follower of Jesus, is called, is set aside to offer Jesus, to offer life. That's important as you think about how you interact and with your own identity and with the people around you. with that idea in mind, that your job as a human is to offer Jesus to others, to offer life, let's look at Proverbs chapter 5, verse 15. It starts this way. It says, "Drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well. Should your spring overflow in the streets, your streams of water in public squares, let them be yours alone, never to be shared with strangers." I like this idea of cisterns, of water, because in the desert, water is what? Life. It's sacred. If you don't have water, you die. And in Jeremiah 2:13, God says this to the people. He says, "My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and they have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water." So I kind of think that there are two ideas that are happening here that I want you to think about. One is that you as a human being, created in the image of God, have life to offer somebody. That you have a cistern of water. You have something good to offer. And it's life-giving. That's very important. That you have something life-giving just in the way you are made. And then second, if you become a follower of Jesus and you begin the process of offering Jesus to people, you have life to offer people. So you not only have the way you were created to offer, but you have Jesus to offer. You have life. And so what this writer of Proverbs is saying, he understands this idea and he's saying, you know what? If you start squandering this goodness, it starts getting tainted. And he's saying, why would you offer what's really good to somebody else who is not supposed to have it? And in particular, he's talking to men. So I want you to think tonight, I have life to offer. I have life in Jesus to offer, and I have life just because I've been created in the image of God. There's something good about my interaction intimately with my friends and then with my husband or wife in the future or in the present. So verse 18 says, "May your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth, and a loving doe, a graceful deer. May her breath satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love." So in particular, at this point in time when this is written, it's being written to a young man, but it can be as much written to a woman. But there's some interest. I don't want to get into a whole bunch of, okay, this is what a woman is, this is what a man is, but in this particular passage, there are some clues about women, who women are, and about who men are. So let's just start with women. He compares this woman to a very graceful animal. It's a very ancient thing to do. It's not very chic right now to, you know, compare women to different kinds of animals as a way of complimenting them. But what he's saying is that the woman that you're married to, or the woman you will marry, she is beautiful. So whatever she looks like, she is beautiful. If she's tall and skinny, then tall and skinny is glorious to you if you're married to her. If she's short and skinny, then short and skinny. If she's, you know, short and you know, larger, then that's glorious to you. Whatever she looks like, that is glorious. And not only that, but it's not just about, you know, what she looks like. It is the very fact that she is woman, that she's beautiful. So, what I think this says about women is that you are an aesthetic. Hear me out. If you're a woman, you are an aesthetic. Not a useful aesthetic, but you're an aesthetic. So if women left this room, all of you got up and walked out, it would be very drab and boring in here. Because part of being a woman is making this world warmer, more beautiful, and more engaging. That's what men are supposed to enjoy. That's what we enjoy. When you walk in as a woman into church on Sunday night, I enjoy it. Because you bring color and vibrance. So if you look around and you look at the art, the best pieces of art in this room are nothing to compare to you. But if there's art here that strikes you, that moves your soul, well, if you're a woman, that's what you are. You're that art that strikes and moves people. So the thing is, if you're a woman, there's some sense of saying, you know what, I'm an ecstatic. I move people. When I walk in, things are good. People are blessed when I'm here. Now, if you're a man, you better enjoy that. But also, good, children aren't paying attention. They are now.
Yeah.
But I'll make it very careful. One of the things that frustrates me about some men's group is that they are men's groups, you know, when people, men get together, is that it's, how to say this, a lot of stimulation and no intimacy. Men like to pretend and be emotional and be, but they're not really intimate, because most men, like myself, since I am, I can speak in authority with this, are scared to death about most things. And so if you want the definition, if somebody says men are supposed to be strong, and you're like, what? Let me tell you what it means. It means that you have to face your fears. You cannot be Adam. You cannot be a stupid man behind a bush thinking God's not going to find you. You have to face your fears. And one of the biggest fears is intimacy with women. But you know what? For most, I talk to most of you, I wrestle with this. It's just not women that we're afraid of. We're afraid of everything. Most of us are afraid of our own shadows. Now, I'm not saying women aren't afraid. I've talked to plenty of women who are afraid. But one of the roles of a man, as a husband, and then as a single man, is to provide safe places for women to be art, for women to be beautiful, to provide a place for them to explore that. The only way to do that is face your fears. Face what you're afraid of. Because let me just draw you a picture of what it's like to be a man, to enjoy the woman of your youth. Well, it's kind of like standing at a cliff and everything's black and dark and chaotic, and you have to step out into it believing that God is going to catch you. But you have to step. And most things in life are like that for men. So anyway, to be strong simply means to face your fears and to face your anxieties and to wrestle through those, and women will present many of them for you. Now, this says that women, that you should be captivated by her love. The actual literal translation of that is intoxicated. You should be intoxicated, drunk with her. More than intoxicated, as my father would say. And that is a volitional thing. Yes, it has some emotional parts to it. But to be captivated by a woman means that you have to be a studier of her. So the other part of being a strong man is that you have to be intentioned. And you have to listen to your father, because this is what the rest of the passage says. Why be captivated, my son, by an adulteress? Why embrace the bosom of another man's wife? For man's ways are in full view of the Lord, and he examines all his paths. The evil deeds of a wicked man ensnare him. The cords of his sin hold him fast. He will die for lack of discipline, led astray by his own great folly. I love that one verse, that the ways of man are in front of God, and he actually thinks about them. So as you're in relationship with each other, as friends, as men and women, in marriage and outside of marriage, God is pondering your ways. God is involved in your ways. God is thinking about them. He's engaged in them. That means that he's deeply concerned that you as a woman step out as a woman, and you as a man step out as a man, whatever context, from work to school to marriage to friendship, God is involved and wants to be engaged. And if you don't listen to your dad, who said it's more than intoxicated, then you end up tied up by your sin and in ruin, because you're not disciplined. So, what I thought tonight we would do is hear a little bit about Rod and Kathy, and about their relationship and about things that they wrestled with, and Let me just preface all this the way I prefaced last week. You're not going to get all the answers tonight. You're not going to get all the answers next week. You're not going to get all the answers if we spent 6 weeks on this. The issue is when they talk, you need to listen. Part of being self-disciplined, part of setting your mind for action, is simply to listen and take in what I say, listen and take in what Kathy and Rod have to say, take in what other people in the community are saying. And wisdom is being able to put that together, figuring out how it applies to you, and acting on it. So tonight, what you want to have happen to you is you want to be implicated, meaning you want to feel like, oh, okay, this is about me. I need to think about this. So, without further ado, remember that sitting up here is kind of terrifying. So, please be kind to Rod and Kathy as they're up here. So if you guys would come up. So I get this. Let me get my wife. You want to try the shorter one, Kathy? You can sit at his
feet.
I'm going to give you this because he's probably more comfortable. Yeah. Well, no, I'm going to give him a hand one. Okay, there you go. I forgot them.
That's why I threw them away. I didn't figure you would follow them.
No.
There. Okay. Now I'm on.
There you go. So what I thought you guys could start with is just to tell us a little bit about how you guys ended up together and what your story was.
Okay. You know, this is hard because this is a lot of years of marriage to concise into 10 or 20 minutes. And we're individuals, and everybody's marriage is different. But with us, I met Rod. I was a freshman in college at Grand Canyon College in Phoenix.
And
he was a sophomore, and we just happened to be in a couple classes together, speech class and archery class. So the very first day of class, we're standing up in speech and introducing ourselves, and that's kind of where we got to know each other, and it was like immediate. We started talking in the parking lot for hours on end and sneaking off at lunch and going to Jack in the Box and, you know, that kind of thing, and started dating, well, a few months after that. When he finally got up the nerve to ask me out, he was very quiet. Well, kind of quiet, and very shy back then. So it took him a while to get the nerve, I think, to ask me out. But we went out literally for 3 years and dated each other exclusively for 3 years, and then got married. So we're different from many of you in the fact that I was 20 when I got married, and Rod was 21. So we've been together a lot of years, and we got married very young. But back then, it wasn't so young. You know, back then, that was the normal age you got married, or even some people got married younger than that. And then we waited about three and a half years before our oldest son, of course, was born, and then Derek came along. But that's kind of our story. Do you have other things to add about our story?
I actually didn't meet her in speech class. She met me in speech class. I met her in archery class because we also had archery class together. And the coach said, you have to get in groups of three. And there were two really pretty girls, one of whom is sitting next to me, that were out there. And I thought, if you got to be in a team of three, I'm all over being in a team of three with two other girls. And guys later figured that out, but I thought I was pretty smart. And so we had archery together. I didn't know that she was like some state champion archer. So we went shooting one time, and she had like this bow with weights and sights and all this crazy stuff, and I was just trying to hit the hay bales, and she was putting, you know, this everything right on the target. So anyway, so I always take the arrow, Cupid's arrow got us. She always talks about the speech class. So anyway, we met in two different classes.
Yeah.
So can you talk just a little bit about your reflections on what it means to enjoy the husband or wife of your youth? Kind of talk a little bit about some of your relational struggles, things you learned early on in your marriage, sexual struggles, anything that you really want to talk about.
Sometimes I think the wedding is the exciting thing, of course, because you as me, I mean, that's what I, thought about and dreamed about my whole life. And then I think early on in our relationship, though, I do say before we even got married, because we dated for 3 years, I really think we had worked a lot of the kinks out. We tended, I think, at first to, of course, we talked all the time. We're together a lot, but we fought a lot. I remember a number of times when I would just, slam the door, go in the house and slam the door and say, I'm not going to talk to you anymore and don't bother to call me, and, that was it. And we just had a lot of fights. And I think it took a few years for us to figure out, how we each other thought, what was important enough to fight about and what wasn't, how to really manage and handle each other. And by the time we got married, I really felt like we had things pretty much under control. And the adjustment, for me anyway, was very, very easy at that point. What about you?
I think there was a lot of... I think we both grew up in Christian homes. And so we had this huge advantage of having godly parents, Christian parents, being raised as Christians, being Christians. We kind of chose to know each other with that whole idea. And I think, for me, I was really scared to get married. I was, like most guys, a coward. And I wanted to be married, but I just, that level of commitment was so huge for me. Because I think even then I understood the power of a vow. And I think to make that vow, to say, this is the woman with whom I'm going to be married, and I'm not leaving, and nothing is going to stop this, and I'm going to live with her until I die, that was a hard decision to make, but it was also one I really wanted to make and chose to make. And I think early in our marriage, Kathy's right, even before we got married, we fought all the time. Matter of fact, people kept saying, you guys are going to get married, all you do is fight. You're always arguing about stuff. And we did. We argued about everything. I mean, from religion, from, politics, to you name it, we fought about it. And we kind of, I think when we chose to love each other, chose to be married, it was hard for me. I think, and then being virgins, I think, was kind of scary, too. Like, I just remember being really terrified about, wanting the sexual aspects, wanting all that, and yet terrified, not sure. But that was kind of, we were young. We were just young. We didn't know. Like, we had no idea what marriage was going to be like. We had no idea how hard it was going to be, how good it was going to be, how bad it was going to be. We just chose to be married. And so that was a lot of, I think, the early years. And it was so hectic, I think, at the beginning, too, of working and going to school and all, working out all the details of life I don't know. We kind of lost the... You're just too wore out to fight after a while.
There was a lot of issues early on. I think finances were a big one, and I think that's one reason that Rod was so hesitant to get married in the first place. How am I going to support a wife? I was going to college at the time, and he was... I think you'd quit college by then, but you were working, and, as a part salesman, and it's like he was a little concerned, and that's been a struggle, the early part of our marriage. Finances were a big struggle, and have been probably throughout, so I'd say that was one of the things that you just have to work out, we took turns over the years. We had kind of a unique relationship, I think, and the fact that The first year I went finished up my college at the university, and then decided that we kind of made the decision that Rod should go back and get his degree, finish it up. So then I worked, and he went and got his degree. And then we had a kid in there, and so he was kind of working and taking care of a kid. And then after that, I think we both worked for a while, and then, of course, the kids came. And as the second one came, then I kind of went more to part-time. And so we had kind of a relationship of back and forth of, me being sometimes a total breadwinner, and then sometimes he being, and sometimes co-sharing. So that kind of helped with the finances a little bit. But then that creates a struggle too when you have a mom that's a full-time that works full-time. There was a lot of struggles, I think, at that point, and not so much maybe a little bit resentment on my part during those years that I couldn't be a full-time homemaker like some of my friends were, and I couldn't devote my full time to my kids. But you just work that out. I saw how great that Rod did with the boys and how involved that he was in their lives. And I thought, you saw a lot of other fathers out there that worked all day and came home and were tired and sat in front of the TV or played a little with their kids, but Rod was busy and worked with the boys, all day long. So I could kind of see ways that maybe I wasn't doing all I could do as far as a parent, but Rod was stepping in. And so a lot of the stuff we did over the years was kind of like co. As far as the first, just a few little things when we first got married that I learned, it took me a while to, I don't know if all women are like this, but I tended to be a little like, there were some things about Rod that I really wanted to kind of change a little bit. And I don't know if men are so much like that, but
are.
Well, there were just a few little things I wanted to tweak. For the most part, he was pretty good. But and I think the first part of your marriage, you really spend like, trying. I know I nagged a lot more than I should have and threw out hints of things that I thought would be better. And after a while, when like Rod ignored me for like ever, and he never changed, and I just thought, I just got more and more frustrated, and finally it dawned on me that, he's never going to change, so like, get over it. So I think that was one of the big things in my life when I started getting a little less naggy and a little bit more accepting and a little bit more looking at the positive things about Rod and not wanting to always fix him, and then taking those things that were frustrations in my own life. For example, well, one just a real quick example, and just one, is that okay? One would be, like, this is just a minor thing, but, we moved into an old house, and a lot of things needed fixing, like the plumbing that was leaking and the toilet that kept running and all of this stuff. And I thought that men were supposed to be able to do things like that, and, like, wanted to do things like that, but I found out that that's not necessarily true. So it took a long time for me to understand, come on, you need to fix this. And then, eventually he'd go try to fix it, and it would get worse and worse. And, so you just, eventually I just came up with other ideas. There are other alternatives in life and other ideas. So, the way I fixed that was my dad lived about a mile away, and I just said, Dad, come over and fix this, and he would come over and fix it. So that worked out okay in our lives. But I guess it's a matter sometimes of, number one, saying you aren't going to change that person, really. He is who he is. I'm who I am. I mean, I can't even change myself, hardly someone else, and just learning to accept that and then coming to some method to fix it between the two of you. And with Rod, he thought it was great that my dad came over and fixed stuff. So it worked out real well.
I think there was a lot of pressure to live up to her expectations. I wanted to do that. I wanted to be the man that she thought I was, or the dog thought I was. And you kind of want to be that. But I also, my dad died. He was very sickly. He never taught me how to do all those things. I just had no skill set there. I was not. And when I did try, I often failed. I do remember actually the time when Kathy decided to cheer for me and to be for me instead of nagging me about what I wasn't, when she decided to tell me what I was. And I have to tell you, she's always done that. She's been very good at saying, you're really good at that, or this is something you do well, or I really admire what you do here. My advice to you wives, and you would-be wives, you will change a lot more about your husband when you choose to tell him what he's good at over what he's bad at. He's already well aware of what he's bad at, and he really doesn't need the reminders. Matter of fact, the reminders are so discouraging, and I remember that constant nagging didn't make me want to be better. It made me want to run, made me want to hide, made me want to not come home, made me want to stay at work, made me want to get away, because that was just hard. And
I, fun. Can you tell, you told me a few stories about how she did that. Can you tell a couple of those?
I think when I started writing, one of the things that I remember writing, starting to write and then showing her what I had written, and she got so excited about what I wrote, and that it was so good, and she made a folder, and she keeps it in the file drawer, and it's, and it was full of the things that I had got, that I had written or that I had gotten published. And so, like, she was just a cheerleader for that. And like when I first started preaching or first started speaking, you know, instead of, I mean, she was, don't get me wrong, she knows how to critique my messages and often has. But she does it after she says, that was really good, or I really like what you did here. And I think I've tried to reciprocate in her life doing that, to call out what I see in her. I know she was a nurse for a long time, and working at this hospital, and she's working as a staff nurse, and they approach her and ask her if she would consider going into management. And I remember she came home and she said, I just don't want to do that. I don't want that pressure. I'm really scared. I don't know I could do that. I just looked at her and said, woman, you are nuts. You are such the manager. You are like the consummate manager. You're like the administrative freak. You know, like, look at how you administer our lives. And, you know, that, I mean, that's her gift. Administration is a gift. And I knew, because I had a degree in business administration, which I seldom use, but because I'm not administrative or as administrative. But it was just beautiful just to be very intentional about calling that out of her, and then seeing that rewarded, seeing her bosses just rave about her work, and seeing all those tens on the score of, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10 in every area of management and those kind of things. So I think we worked hard at, we learned to do that. I think early on we were eager to point out each other's flaws. Do you know, like, she doesn't turn caps onto jars, and she doesn't put lids back on the way they're supposed to be.
So they fall
and then
off.
And then she puts them in the refrigerator, and of course I always pull things out by the lid. So, you know, it's those kinds
of
things.
You learn after a while.
Those kinds of things you just had to work out, you know, that we just don't have the same way of looking at life.
You know, just real quick, I want to say too that I think that's so important in a marriage, because, you know, when you've been married for 32 or 3 years, you are a different person than when you were originally, you know, 20 years old or 17 when I met Rod. And we change. And I know Rod has encouraged me, and I tried to encourage him, like, for this preaching. This was like a thing out of the blue sky. You know, here I want to go preach. It's like, oh, okay. But I knew he'd be good at it, and he was, obviously, and we were willing to make some moves and some changes to do that. So another time I remember when I wanted to start a Bible study in our church, a women's Bible study, and he was just like my real cheerleader, and took it to the consistory and the council and talked to them about it, and we got this great women's Bible study going at the church, and he helped me out with that routinely. And it's just kind of, I think that it's just, that's part of being married, to see what someone is good at and just to really encourage him in that way. Yeah, like our date day. You want to talk about our date day?
Sure. When I was going to become a pastor, one of the things was they sent me to this assessment center, Kathy and I, to find out whether we could actually do that or whether I could do this. And part of that assessment center, I remember we were sitting in the hotel room or afterwards, and this guy sitting on a chair kind of going over the results of this two days of interaction, and he said, "We're really worried, Rod, that about one thing, and that's that you get so involved in the work that you could abandon your wife and your children." And I remember being outraged by that because I felt like, no, that's never going to happen, and I don't do that sort of thing. So I was kind of kicking back against that. And so he looked at Kathy and he said, "So what do you think?"
Yes, he was right.
And she, of course, having had seen me when I was in my full-fledged Charlie Jones, going to become the next president of the company, where I would leave at 6 o'clock in the morning and come home at 10 o'clock at night, and was also an elder in the church, and was also president of the school board, and God knows what else I was doing. And I was busy, and I was important, and all those things. And I just remember when she said, "Yeah, he could do that," that just hit me like a ton of bricks, and I felt really wounded by that. Like, wow, that I'm capable of doing that, because when I was doing all those things, I felt like I was doing them for her. I was becoming the president of Charlie Jones for her. I was for my family. I was the president of the school because that's the school our kids went to, and I wanted to, you know, like, I was doing this for people, for them. That was my purpose. And so to realize that she didn't think that way, she just wanted me and wanted me around and wanted my presence. And so I just made a vow. Like, in that moment, I said, "Whatever your day off is my day off." And we've kept that. And on Mondays, she has off, and I have off, and it's our date day. And I know a lot of you have said, "Can we get together Monday?" Or, you know, "Can we have coffee or lunch?" Or, no, you can't, because it's our day together. And I think we just very intentionally go on dates. We go to the movies. We go out to lunch. We, you know, sit in the hot tub and talk. We hang out at home. We just spend time together and talk about what's going on in our lives and talk about where we struggle and just, you know, take a nap and because we're getting old now. But it's just hanging out together. Yeah. And I think it was a vow I made. And I think when you ask, like, the intentionality of that, it was like she made a vow not to, you know, I remember when she told her Bible study group, you know, "I've been nagging Rod and he hasn't changed, and instead I'm going to," and she kind of made it an accountability thing in that whole community, because people had asked me about it and talked to me about it, that she had just decided that she was going to love the man that she married rather than try to make him into something he wasn't.
You know, too, over the years, it's not just recently, but I remember when our boys were little, too, we went into and decided to do square dancing. And it's like Rod says, "Oh, there's a square dance group meeting over at such and such church. Let's go do it." And it's like, I never even, like, hardly heard
you
of square dancing.
You were the one who went to square dance.
Well, whatever. But anyway, we went. I didn't know really what it was, but we went, and it was, like, the most fun. We had this group, and, yeah, to do something together. So he'd heard of this group that met, so we went into that. And we did that for a number of years, and we would go to little out-of-town things, and we would go once or twice a week to square dance, and that was kind of like our thing together, and we just had the greatest time. So sometimes it's just finding something that's really fun that you enjoy doing together and to do it. But then I do have to say that part of being married for 33 years is that we don't do everything together. I mean, why have, you know, after dinner I go do my thing, and he goes and does his thing, and it's like sometimes you just need some time apart, too. And over the years, he's, you know, done his writing, or he's golfed, or he's done different things, and he didn't want me to learn how to golf. No way. So, you know, I did my little crafts, and I did my women's Bible study and did my thing. So I think part of it is developing separate interests as well, that at least for us two, we didn't have to do everything together. We did a lot of church activities together, a lot of family things, but not everything. And I think that was important, too.
Mm-hmm.
we were doing the square dancing and things like that when they were actually younger, and we would have babysitters, you know, when we went out and did things. But this actual date day, like, you know, was actually when they were probably more like teenagers when we started that. We've been doing it for a long time.
But even when, we always did try to find, you know, time together. And but you know what? You're not going to find it, so you just have to make it. And you have to agree that, like, this sounds horrible, but you have to schedule it. Like, you have to say, this is going to be the time when we go do this. Otherwise, I guarantee you it won't happen, because there was always a million things.
And there was a number of years when he was just really busy all the time, and we just didn't do as much. But and what you did with the kids. But, yeah, this date day has been a commitment for a long time, and something we both really enjoy. So. Oh, I love that question. That's a good question. Yes. You know, that's a good question. You know, I was thinking just a few things over of our marriage, but, you know, what keeps a couple together for 33 years? And, you know, I like to say, oh, it's that wonderful love that you had when you were first dating and you were first married. And, you know, obviously that love, yeah, right. But it changes. Love changes. You know, there's no doubt about that. Love is a feeling, and that changes. But what I really think keeps us together has been a commitment, and that's all it is. You say, you know, when we took those vows, we both, you know, being Christians, being really committed to God and to growing with God, when we took those vows, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, I mean, we've had all of that. And I remember, you know, as long as you both shall live, forsaking all others, you know, those vows were really important to us. And that's what gets you through, is that commitment that you are married to this person. And I can't remember really throwing out, even with the arguments that we had, and we had a few arguments over the years, but never really throwing out, I'm going to leave you, I want you to leave, I'm going to get divorced. It just wasn't really conversation that we had with those particular words. I might have actually thought sometimes, I wish he'd go, but like, he's so big, and he won't go, and so I guess I got to stay and work this out, you know? It's like, you can't throw him out when he's this big, but so we worked a lot, you know, we had to work things out, and so I think the whole key is that you are committed. These are the vows that you took. This is what you're going to live with and by, and you are going to forsake all others when it comes to, you know, other people. You know, we talked about temptations in our marriage, and I can't even say, unfortunately, Rod's had a few temptations from other women, but I can't even say that any guy has even cared about me. But I think part of it is not putting yourself in that position, you know, to be around, you know, other men, or in Rod's case, other women, and that kind of thing, to develop that kind of relationship. Because I really think that you probably could be happy with a lot of different people. You know, it just happened that we were together right at that point in our lives when we were looking, you know, for a relationship and old enough to get married. And there's other people out there, I think, that we could have been just as compatible with. But once you make that decision, that's a great question. Once you make that decision, then you just live by it.
There are lots of times when I didn't like Kathy at all, in that moment you're really angry, and it's interesting that that's when temptation does come. And I also realized some things about power and money. I know when I became the chief financial officer of the corporation, I kind of jumped from like three levels down to that level, so it was quite a big jump. And suddenly, there were women that were just fascinated with me, and they just thought, they hung on my every word, and they just thought I was really smart and brilliant, and they thought we had money, and and that I had this huge salary. Boy, were they! And so suddenly, there were propositions, there were opportunities, and I think that's also very important when that moment comes, to be able to say, you know, I made this vow, and I sealed this vow with this ring, and this vow will not be broken by me. You know, I can't be responsible if Kathy would choose to break it, but I will not break this vow. And when she says, I know he's not going to leave, and I get, she's right. I'm not going to leave willingly. And so, but that, again, that is a choice. But yeah, there's often days when, there are days now when we really don't like each other, and we're angry about with each other, and we're upset by what the other person did or said, or and so we have to work.
And you know, I think in our life too, with me working forever, and I mean, it wasn't like I've worked with people who, you know, my age or younger that have left their husbands, because guess what? They can do better without them, and they can support themselves and their kids without them, and they don't need them, and they're not meeting their expectations. And so, you know, that temptation could have been there all along, that I have the wherewithal that I could leave, but it just wasn't there.
I think for us, when love was, if love was just an emotion, it's just a feeling, then it comes and goes. And but in our case, love is a vow. It's a choice. It's a vow that we actually made before God. And we know that, you know, I was reading, when you read this, for a man's ways are in full view of the Lord. When I made that promise, I made it in front of God. And he says, you keep your vow. You know, don't make it if you're not going to keep it. And so we chose to keep it.
One last question.
I think when you make the choice, like when I'm angry with Kathy, I want to punish her. I want to get even with her. I want to, you know, it becomes competition. And so when I decide that I'm not going to win this competition, because, you know, early on in our marriage, I made Kathy submit. Matter of fact, I don't think men should be allowed to use the word submit ever. I don't think they should ever ask their wives to submit. I think wives need to submit to their husbands on occasion, because Scripture says that. But I think all men should ever concentrate on is how to love, and how to love well. And because that's where men don't do it. We just don't do it. We want our way. We want what we want. And so I think early on, like, I remember even the decision about what church we were going to go to.
Oh, I want to tell that.
No. You had your chance. She wanted to go to the church that she had spent her whole life in. I wanted to go to the church I had spent my whole life in. And I just made the arbitrary decision, we can't do that, and we're going to go to my church, and you're going to follow me. And you know what? She did. She submitted, and she even told the elders when she came and joined the church, I'm not joining this church because I love this church. I'm doing it out of submission to my husband, because he told me I have to. And you know what? She submitted, but she wasn't happy. And you know what? It wasn't very loving what I did, and it caused her a lot of pain, and she didn't like that church. We were just talking about it the other day. She didn't like that church the whole time we were there.
It wasn't quite that bad, but
right.
You know.
But I forced her to do it, and I think, I won. But what did I win? And I think that's when you start realizing that what you win isn't what you thought you wanted. You don't get what you wanted. Now I find when I serve her, like, I love to cook, and when she comes, so like I like to have dinner ready. So when she walks in from the hospital and she's exhausted and she's tired. Wow, you know, here's a hot meal sitting here, you know, because that makes her eyes light up, and that leads to good things, you know, like good things for me.
When I'm tired or when I'm hungry, I'm not pleasant. Yeah.
And so I think when you realize that your strategy doesn't work, then you change strategy.
And, you know, our decisions later in life were made much more mutually. And I think that's fair, you know, for the big decisions in life, for both of you to commit to them. And that way, if they go awry, you don't have anyone to blame either. You know, it's like we both made this decision and we're going to stick by it no matter what. And I think that that's the most important. It didn't start out that way because he was the head of the house, but it changed after all.
When our real estate lady, when we were looking for a house, our real estate lady took us out to dinner one night, and she said, I can't find the house because you guys are looking for two different houses. Kathy wanted, guess what, a new house with everything that worked, you know, because she knows her husband. And I wanted an old house in the, you know, barrio or someplace. Anyway, so it was kind of funny because I remember at the end of that meeting just deciding, I want the house that makes Kathy's eyes light up, that's within our budget, obviously. So.
Can you give them a hand? Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Rod and Kathy. Thank you very much. Let's close in prayer. Dear God, thank you for this community, and in particular tonight, we thank you for Kathy and Rod and how they led us in just to a little bit of their story over the last 30 years. And you have been so faithful to them and walked through a lot of tough things and some good things. And Lord, I just ask that you would bless them and that you would bless us. And we ask this in your name, Jesus. Amen. Tonight, guys, there's a couple ways that you can respond. One is through offering, and I'm going to pass that through. If you would just pass the basket around. If you're visiting, you don't need to give. We're just happy to have you. The other way to respond is we're just going to listen to some music. You can meditate, and we'll sing some songs together. And the other way is that there is communion back there and right over there. And we just ask that you be able to say that you stand with Jesus and his broken body and his blood poured out for you. Otherwise, we'd appreciate if you would not take that. So let's just spend some time responding to God.